Thanks, John. And as he mentioned in his prayer, the reason we continue to have presentations from this platform on Israel is because that's really where the action is in relation to God's plan and purpose with this earth. Last week, for those of you who are here, we had a presentation on anti-Semitism, which continues to be an issue within the world that we live. And certainly the events today, last week anyway, are cause for concern in terms of where the world is going. So tonight I'd like to first of all present a few random thoughts on the Middle East in general, just strange sort of things that go on that are probably not noticed too much in the news. We'd then like to have a look at some current issues that have been in the news in the last 12 days or so, 10 or 12 days, and point out that there's quite a change that goes on in any sort of 10-day period in relation to news from the Middle East. Then I'd like to draw your attention to two sets, remarkable sets of prophecies. One of them will come from Psalm 83. We'll have a brief look at that and introduce some thoughts. The other set comes from the prophet Isaiah and begins in the chapter that John read for us, chapter 11, and goes to chapter 35. So these two chapters, chapter 11 of Isaiah and chapter 35, basically act as bookends for a remarkable set of prophecies regarding the world in which we live. And hopefully we can demonstrate that. We have some prophecies from that of specific oracles against nations, and we have some prophecies from that regarding the Messianic age. So this is a package, really, from Isaiah chapter 11 to 35 that demonstrates to us God's plan with Israel, with the nations, and with the future coming of the Messiah. We'll close, hopefully, with a call to action that comes from the prophet Isaiah himself. Now, one of the first things that is strange, and I think the presentation last week touched on it a little bit, is the imbalance in what goes on in the Middle East in relation to religious responses. I'm sure that most of you realize that the nation of Syria almost encompasses the city of Antioch, the ancient city of Antioch, and certainly the city of Damascus and the ancient city of Antioch were foundational cities in the spread of the gospel once it had moved north from Jerusalem. You remember that Paul met the Lord on his way to Damascus because there were Christians there that he was going to sanction and persecute. And it had, as well, moved on from there to Antioch, which now I think is the ancient city of Antioch is actually in Turkey, but at the time it was part of Syria. So there's a long, long history of Christianity in Syria that goes right back to the days of the Apostle Paul. These are Christians that have a little different position than sort of normal Catholics, but are still fundamentally descended from the original Christians that were in that area. Well, they're being targeted, of course, in this current civil war that's going on in Syria because they have been seen as favoring the current leadership in Israel in Syria, so are coming under attack. And so, therefore, Christians are almost open season in Syria. But it's not just that, because if you look at news that's coming out of Egypt today, you'll see in this article that I've picked up from the Times Colonist on Friday. Christians in Egypt are being black marked with X's and marked out for persecution. And as you go south in Egypt towards Sudan and Somalia, there's outright burning and looting of Coptic Christian churches. Now, this isn't something that was going on years ago. It's going on right now as we speak. And there is no apparent response from the government to control this. So there's this amazing destruction and massacre of Christians and Christian artifacts, the destruction of the history of Christianity in North Africa, and the long history in Syria, being destroyed and basically obliterated without any response from the authorities. This is a frightening thing, but it's also, I think, something that shows us the response that the Islamic nations are moving towards in relation to Christianity. Now, on the other side of that, I picked this up from BBC Online. It was also September the 12th. And many of you may remember this controversial, as it says, U.S. pastor who threatened to burn a Quran in 2010, I think it was. He actually burnt one in 2011. And when he burnt one Quran, there was a massive and deadly protest that erupted around the world at this terrible violation of Islamic rights and so on. So on the one hand, you see how that the destruction of Christianity can carry on with impunity, and there doesn't seem to be any real even press coverage of any degree. But when Terry Jones, on September the 11th, tried to update his protest against Islam by burning approximately 3,000 Qurans that were evidently soaked in kerosene, he's going to have a big barbecue, and he was driving along in his pickup truck pulling this barbecue, and they arrested him because he was transporting flammable liquids or dangerous liquids without a permit or something. So they stopped the barbecue, and I guess what would have happened if he'd have actually burnt the 3,000 Qurans. So there it is, you see. If you're in Egypt and you're Islamist in southern Egypt, you can go and kill Coptic Christians and destroy their churches and loot their artifacts and destroy them. But if you burn a Quran in Florida, you're in a heap of trouble, boy. And that's what they did with Pastor Jones. They arrested him. I'm not sure the outcome of that, but I think once they got a hold of all of his kerosene-soaked Qurans, they probably let him go. Now, this is a blog I picked up, actually was sent to me, from IsraelNationalNews.com. And some of you may feel it's a bit harsh, but I think by the time we sort of go through it in some depths, you can see that it is nevertheless the truth. The notion, of course, is that somehow if we just get rid of Israel, there'll be peace on earth. Because all of this unrest in the Middle East is going on because of Israel. This is not true, of course. In fact, it's absolute nonsense. And yet that's what is being presented in the international press. So this guy who writes a blog in the Israel National News says, Israel or Palestine is not a state. It doesn't exist. They talk about Palestine. Right? They're talking about peace, and they're going to have some more peace talks in the near future to figure out whether they can have, you know, the two-state thing, which was the Oslo idea some years ago that didn't sort of work out. So Palestine is not a state. It doesn't exist. But don't tell Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, this, because for Abbas, Palestine doesn't just exist. It exists in place of Israel, and that's the point, I think, of this article. You see the occasional picture of Abbas in his office or at a PA-sponsored gathering. In such pictures, Abbas sits or stands proudly in front of a map that displays his new state of Palestine, but unhappily, it just is superimposed over the state of Israel. So to him, and this is why I guess peace talks never go anywhere, because the outcome, of course, to the Palestinians is that it will result in the end of the state of Israel. So the United States may speak about peace in the Middle East. The European Union may speak of two nations living side by side in peace and security. But for Mr. Abbas, peace means only one thing: Israel erased from the map. This is why you get this sort of double speak all the time, where people are talking about peace, but peace actually means the obliteration of Israel, and then peace will come, which, again, is something that we'll see just wouldn't happen. Read the PLO charter, he goes on to say. Read the Hamas charter. Listen to Arab TV. Peace comes when Israel is gone, evidently. That's the line. So Abbas is like a proud papa. He loves to talk about his baby, but he wants his baby to obliterate the state of Israel. The European Union, meanwhile, accuses Israel of rejecting peace. Israel, of course, isn't for peace. And why would they be? Because peace means the obliteration of their state. The UN accuses Israel of causing unrest throughout the Middle East. Everyone agrees, solve the Israel problem and there will be peace. So he goes on to say, okay, let's solve that problem. Take Israel off the map, destroy the Jewish state, put Palestine in its place. Now, with Israel gone, answer these questions, he says. Does oppression against Arab citizens in Gaza suddenly stop? Do human rights abuses in Syria suddenly end when Israel is off the map? Does Lebanon become a new model for economic vitality when Israel is gone? Well, for answers, start with Egypt, Syria, and Libya. With Israel gone, will these three states and their violent state streets become quiet? With Israel gone, will the enmity among Arab citizens and the enmity that they have towards their governments, will it evaporate? With Israel gone, will any Arab country become instantly peaceful? No. I think everybody agrees to that. If Israel disappears, the streets of the Middle East will not magically fill with Audis and Mercedes automobiles. They, in fact, will choke with donkeys and sewage. Now, I know, as I say, that might be a harsh thing to say, but in fact, it is absolutely true. And I have a kind of a sort of personal interest in this, because when the Israeli army pulled everybody out of Gaza, there were magnificent greenhouse operations there that the Israelis had, and they grew peppers and tomatoes and lettuce and cucumbers and all sorts of things and exported them all over the world. They were greenhouses that would be kind of an envy for me, having been in the greenhouse industry for 13 years. So they pulled out, and what did the citizens of Gaza do? They started smashing them up, which was, I thought, most remarkable and bizarre. In fact, I think they pretty much destroyed all of them, the infrastructure and the buildings of these greenhouses. Well, anyway, that's maybe beside the point. Israel is the Middle East's lifeline to survival. It develops modern healthcare, and this is what our speaker presented last week in terms of what Israel does. High-tech innovation and advanced education, and shows the Arabs how to survive in the 21st century. Israel becomes the model for all of the nations around in terms of how to survive in a semi-arid area, produce food, and so on. Israel demonstrates how a tiny nation with virtually no natural resources can become one of the most technologically sophisticated nations in the world. Israel is the model for survival in the Middle East. By contrast, most of the Arab world wallows in sewage-soaked poverty. If Israel disappears, that poverty will only get worse. And I think we'll stop reading there. There's all sorts of other evidence of what he's saying here. It's a sad reality, really, that what prosperity there is in the Middle East is really centered around Israel. Now, here's another kind of interesting issue here. In Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 7, the prophet Ezekiel sees in a vision an invasion of the land of Israel. And the invaders come against a land of unwalled villages. Now, I don't have an explanation of all of this tonight. I'm just putting it out as another one of those things that we need to think about when we review the Middle East. Now, you'll see the graphic at the top. If you can see the small print, and you always need to read the small print, it talks about the apartheid wall. So, you know, this has got some prejudice behind it, and it was put together by the Electronic Intifada .net. So this is clearly a biased graphic, and what they're doing in the graphic is trying to compare the Berlin Wall, the old Berlin Wall, in sort of length and height and size to the walls that are being built or have been built through the center of Palestine, if we can call it Palestine, dividing the Arabs and Israel. Now, I think they've got the thing a little bit bigger than it actually is, but nevertheless, this is a huge wall that is there. It's concrete. We had sort of, I guess, have had images of the breaking down and destruction of the Berlin Wall. They don't come down easy, these big concrete walls. So here we have, as we review the Middle East, a land of walled villages, when Bible prophecy clearly talks about an invasion from the north that comes against a land of unwalled villages. So that's an outstanding issue, I suggest. Now, of course, we also know that Israel is surrounded by enemies. This red ink on this map here is, in fact, a truthful representation of Islamic countries that exist north, to the north, to the east, the west, and the south of Israel. And so Israel is this little yellow dot in the middle, and it is completely disproportionate in terms of populations, 1.2 billion Islamic people, 13 or 14 million Israelis in the middle, being basically the bastion of development, of survival, of well-ordered societies, of education and productivity, and so on. It's an interesting, challenging problem. So now we have some events that go back to September the 6th. And this, of course, is something that is a fear as a side issue in the events that are taking place right now in the Middle East. And that is another conflict between Iraq and Iran. Now, they were, of course, in deadly conflict for a number of years before the Iraq war. But that situation still exists, and there are issues within the populations of Iraq and Iran that are still kind of breeding grounds for conflict. According to intelligence reaching Baghdad, Iran has organized Iraqi Shiite terrorist groups ready to strike U.S. and other foreign targets inside Iraq in response to a U.S. strike against Syria. This was reported by Iraqi security forces Friday. So it just increases our understanding of what a tinderbox, what a terrible situation exists there. Oh, and the Chinese evidently were going to bring a landing craft in with 1,000 Marines to kind of hang out and be there and sort of show their presence in all of this. September the 6th, Western naval sources reported Friday that a Chinese landing craft, Jingishan, with 1,000-strong Marine battalion, had reached the Red Sea en route for the Mediterranean off Syria. According to Debka file, Beijing has already deployed a number of warships off of Syria in secret, so the Chinese has a naval presence there off the shores of Syria. If the latest report is confirmed, this would be the largest Chinese deployment in the Middle East in naval history. So, and the Russians are there. So the Western nations are there, the UN, the US, France, Britain, and so on, and the Chinese and the Russian Navy. Russian Navy spokesman said Friday that the fleet building up in the Mediterranean can answer any development after the Shmetlevy guided missile destroyer set sail for the Mediterranean. Since Wednesday, Moscow has reported 6 warships have been sent out to reinforce the Russian fleet on hand outside of Syria. Now, there's obviously a lot of bluff and bluster in all of this, and I think we understand that. If you went online and looked at, you can get reports on the size of the current size of the Russian Navy, and the boats are listed and the types of boats that they have there are listed. You can get that for the U.S. Navy, you can get that for the British Navy and the French and so on. And the Russian Navy, of course, is a small model of its former self of, say, 20 or 30, 40 years ago. The Chinese Navy, I'm not really sure, I haven't looked at that recently, but this is clearly a bit of grandstanding that's going on. But you can think of the threat and the potential problems that can come up with these types of naval fleets. Now, September the 7th, reports coming out of Washington in the last 24 hours indicate that the U.S. President Barack Obama has resolved not just to degrade Syria's chemical capabilities, but also to take down Bashar Assad's air force destroy his air bases and knock out his ground-to-ground ballistic missiles using giant B-52 bombers and a B-2 stealth bomber. Since the Syrian ruler's chemical stocks can't be destroyed by airstrikes, only by ground forces, Washington is considering taking down his ballistic missiles, depriving him of the delivery vehicle for his poison gas. Now, that was September the 7th. It would appear, and it did appear, to the world that the United States was going to proceed with a military strike against Syria. Now, that's not true as of the 14th, yesterday. They've now had some chats with the Russians and decided that, well, as long as he gives up, Mr. Assad gives up his chemical weapons in the next year, well, they'll let him work on that, which means he can stay in power, and so on. So that seems to be where things are going now. So that shows how quickly things can change in the Middle East, now setting up a whole different scenario. Anyway, what we do know is that the future of the world clearly continues to be kind of on the brink because of events in the Middle East. Now, the fact is, this is nothing new. And the reason why we're excited about this is because the Bible's been talking about this for at least 4,000 years. Has been talking exactly about this for 4,000 years. There's no other situation in the history of the earth that is so accurate and so predictable and so obvious as the biblical records of this conflict that has been going on. Now, I have here a piece of Psalm 83. I don't actually know, and I'm not sure anybody actually knows, when this psalm was written. But I do know that it covers an interesting span of time. You'll notice at the bottom of this particular grouping of verses, it says Assyria has joined with the descendants of Lot. Now, Assyria wasn't there as Assyria, as far as we know, when the original comments were made here about some of these nations. We also know that this psalm has its base in the book of the Judges in the Old Testament, which takes us back 1,500 years B.C. In the time of the Judges, the new nation of Israel that had crossed the Jordan and was establishing itself in Israel, in the land of Israel, as we know it today, was being constantly harassed by enemies. Most of them came from the southeast, especially the Midianites. And there was a great harassment of Midian in the time of the Judges. And the reason we know that that is true, that this is referring to that, if you turn with me to Psalm 83... There is kind of a curse in a way, if you want to see it that way, for a judgment being called down upon these people that were forming an alliance against Israel. Well, anyway, verse 1, O God, do not to keep silent. Be not quiet, O God, be not still. See how your enemies are astir, how your foes rear their heads. So again, there's nothing new about that. We see the same thing happening today. Israel, as we see it biblically, as God's chosen people, and the salvation of the world will be worked out through this light-bearing nation. And it's surrounded today by foes. So with cunning they conspire against your people. They plot against those you cherish, Israel. Come, they say, let us destroy them as a nation, which is exactly what we said about the current president of the Palestinians. Israel needs to be gone. Let us destroy them as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more. We'll put in a Palestinian state. With one mind, they plot together. There's one particular outcome that the nations of the world, including the UN and the European nations and the Islamic nations, is that Israel must be gone. With one mind, they plot together. They form an alliance against you. When they form an alliance against Israel, they're forming an alliance against God. And these include the tents of Edom, the Ishmaelites, of Moab, the descendants of Hagar, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, and Tyre. Now, you may be able to see enough of this map, and you know the layout of the map to know that Assyria is way up at the top. Egypt is down on the bottom left here. And that's not going to work. I lost my my little clicker that I used. I probably loaned it to somebody. Did I? You haven't given it back to me. So you have Ishmael down on the bottom right, and the Ishmaelites were also related to and got together with the Midianites. And the Midianites were descendants of Abraham. Oh. Did I loan it to you? Thank you. Ishmael, down here, worked with the Midianites often. And it was the Midianites that were attacking Israel in the days of the judges. Now, again, as I was saying, Midian, if you check the records in the Old Testament of the descendants of Abraham, was a descendant of Abraham. So these people, basically, all of them that are mentioned here, I think with maybe the exception of Amalek and Philistia, maybe Tyre, were actually related to the Jews, to the Israelites, going way back to their descendants. And, of course, you have Lot here, which was Abraham's nephew. Now, is it that there is a statement being made here that Assyria has joined with the descendants of Lot that widens this thing out to show that there is a bigger and a wider conspiracy against Israel, because now it takes in some of the major nations of the world. Now, what I want to just move to is this remarkable set of prophecies from Isaiah chapter 11 through to chapter 35. And just as a summary of this, we find a reoccurring reference to the day of the Lord, a particular day. This is referred to at least 50 times in the 24 chapters. It's also referred to in other ways as the time and so on, but it's obvious that these chapters are speaking about a day. There are oracles or prophecies regarding over 15 surrounding nations, all nations that surrounded Israel at the time and also surround the modern land masses, with many of the names being the same. In these chapters, from 11 to 35, you have indictments not only against 15 surrounding nations, but really, really severe indictments against Israel and Judah, that were the two nations of Israel. It also predicts a devastated earth and a devastated environment embedded within these chapters. It is interspersed with words of redemption, not just all at the end or all at the beginning, but interspersed throughout the 24 chapters, words of redemption and hope, not only for Israel, but for many of the indicted nations as well. So there will be a time of peace. There will be a day when this issue will be resolved, says Isaiah in these 24 chapters. And it won't just bring peace to Israel. It will bring peace to the whole world. It begins, as we saw in the reading, with the promise of Messiah, referred to as the branch. It includes, in chapter 11, a number of nations that we will see are all there today. It assumes that when this day happens, when the Messiah appears to resolve the issues of the Middle East and bring about peace, that all of these nations will be there in the land, including Israel. Otherwise, the prophecies don't work. It concludes with a redeemed Zion in a new, miraculously different, reconstructed world. It begins with the supernatural that we read in chapter 11, and it ends with the supernatural that is in chapter 35 and much of what we sang about in the opening this evening. So back to the map. The nations are all there, Syria way up at the north and so on. I haven't put all the other ones on here, but we have an oracle against Babylon. Babylon is way up at the top and to the right, to your right of this map. In the space of about 120 years, there were a number of nations that we'll see in the history of Isaiah's writing, a number of nations in play, including Egypt, Judah, Israel, Syria, with its capital in Damascus, Assyria, with its capital in Nineveh, and an emerging threat from the northeast, being the Babylonians. And those were the major forces that were in play when Isaiah writes these oracles against the Philistines. They've been there pretty much since before the time of David and before the time of the judges. Samson, of course, and the judges was dealing with the Philistines. Still there, occupying the same land. Against Moab. Moab was one of the descendants of Lot, children of Lot. Damascus, and we talked about this last week, the city of Damascus. Against Cush, which is sort of southern Egypt today, against Egypt. Against Arabia, going out into the south east. Against Assyria, chapter 14 and chapter 31. Remember, Syria was a big threat in the days of Isaiah. Against Tyre, against all nations, basically, inclusive of whomever they were. But also against Israel. The prophet does not spare Israel, because the problem with Israel was that they were an obstinate nation. They did not do what the Lord had asked them to do. They were the light-bearing nation of the world, and they refused to do that and be the light-bearing nation. In fact, Isaiah is pretty clear that they were no better or worse than the surrounding nations. So therefore, in that state, God had no mandate to keep them there in the land. So they were going to suffer a similar fate to the rest of the nations. He speaks of the city where David settled, chapter 29, verse 1, in terms of a series of woes, calling Jerusalem Ariel. The Lord Almighty, in chapter 22 and verse 5, has a day, here again is the term day, of tumult and trampling and terror in the Valley of Vision, Jerusalem, a day of battering down walls and of crying out to the mountains. So Israel was included in these series of terrible prophecies against the nations. Now, there's three here that we just want to have a quick look at. One concerning Damascus, and the presenter last week talked about this. Bible students are pretty much agreed that the city of Damascus, where it is today, has been one of the most longest occupied cities on earth that we know of. It was there in the days of Abraham, as we were told last week. It hasn't really been disinhabited or destroyed so that archaeologists could go down underneath and have a look at it, because the city as it is today is pretty much based on the foundations of the old city. So they really can't go back and check it out, but we believe that it's probably one of the oldest occupied cities. But the prophet says it will no longer be a city, become a heap of ruins. And it's more than that, because there's a word, Aroer, here, which is kind of peculiar, because we're not sure exactly where the cities of Aroer were. There were a few biblical cities named Aroer, but they weren't anywhere near Damascus. But in any case, many of these Hebrew words have meanings, and Aroer means something like stripped naked. So that seems to fit in with the prophecy that the cities will be stripped naked, deserted, and left to flocks, which will lie down with no one to make them afraid. So that's ultimate devastation. The city just doesn't exist. It's just grasslands, and goats and sheep are feeding. That day their strong cities will be left. And here's the point I wanted to make here, which they left because of the Israelites. So it would appear that the destruction of Damascus is associated with an invasion of the Israelites, turning the city into places abandoned to thickets and underbrush, and all will be desolation. I'm not sure where I'd want to go with that, but it's certainly there embedded in the text. Egypt. See, the Lord rides in a swift cloud and is coming to Egypt. The idols of Egypt tremble before him, and the hearts of the Egyptians melt within them. Here's a remarkable statement. This is a statement of civil war. This is exactly what we have in Egypt today. I will stir up Egyptian against Egyptian. Brother will fight against brother. Neighbor against neighbor. City against city. Kingdom against kingdom. Now, I think we all kind of understand watching this from the distance that we have, the safe, comfortable distance, that these types of wars don't end soon. They don't end easily. And this is true with Syria. It's true with Egypt. What we have happening in these two nations and in other areas in the Islamic world are long-term bitter disputes that will take generations to resolve. And I say that because there is no solution within the civil war mentality of these places. There's no resolution within them. The earth, Isaiah says, will be completely laid waste and utterly plundered, which is consistent with what he said about Damascus and how that the city would just be completely destroyed. The earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. And the reason we want to bring these forward is because this grouping of prophecies has the whole picture of the day when all of this comes to an end. It has an earth that is polluted. It has nations in conflict around the nation of Israel. It has a nation of Israel that is not responding and living as they should, according to their mandate with their God. And we have prophecies that speak of the end of times and the bringing in of the kingdom of God on earth. So you basically have the whole package. Here are some of the Messianic Age prophecies. Chapter 11, verse 10, "In that day the root of Jesse," and this is sort of metaphoric language that the prophets use, poetic language, "standing as a banner for the people." This has never happened in history before, but this is, again, part of the package. When all these things line up and come together, and the nations rally to him, and his place of rest will be glorious. So this is a statement of the Messianic Age when the peoples of the earth accept the Messiah of Israel, the descendant of David, and peace comes. "For the Lord Almighty will reign on Mount Zion in Jerusalem." This is why peace comes, "and before its elders gloriously." Chapter 24, verse 23. "And the sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove the disgrace of his people from all the earth. Israel and Jerusalem will be exalted as the capital of the world." And Isaiah talks about that in chapter 4. So he says in chapter 28 and verse 16, "I lay in Zion a stone, a test stone, a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation. The one who trusts will never be dismayed." And these are solid messianic prophecies that are embedded in the text of Isaiah. And they're interspersed. As you can see, the verses here come from chapter 11 to chapter 28, interspersed within and embedded within the rest of the prophecies. Well, "So the Lord Almighty will come down to do battle on Mount Zion and on its heights like a bird hovering overhead. The Lord Almighty will shield Jerusalem. He will shield it and deliver it. He will pass over it and will rescue it." So this is kind of like the type of liberation that happened in the Passover. There's some embedded words here that seem to bring that together as well. I know a number of years ago I had a picture of a helicopter flying over Jerusalem, and I thought that was kind of cool, that this was like the bird hovering overhead and the Lord protecting his people. "Well, all of this will happen because the Lord is exalted, for he dwells on high. He will fill Zion with justice and righteousness. He will be the sure foundation for your times, a rich store of salvation and knowledge and wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the key to this treasure." So the hope is held out not only to Israel, but to all the nations and all the world, that there will be hope in Zion, that there will be a reign of justice and righteousness. And the world needs to buy into this, because that's the key. The knowledge of the Lord is the key to this treasure of peace and everlasting righteousness. Let's just go back for a moment to Isaiah chapter 11, because I think here there are these remarkable things that are stated that can only be fulfilled in a coming kingdom of God on earth. "This branch," this Messiah of Israel, "will bear fruit," it says. And this is the fruit. "The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge," by the way, like other people judge, human beings judge, and that is by what we see and what we hear. This Messiah, this coming king of the earth, will judge with righteous judgment. That's how he will judge the needy. With justice, he will give decisions for the poor. But if you go to verse 6 as well, of chapter 11, the wolf will lie with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox, and so on. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand in the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. This is a picture of the kingdom of God on earth and the supernatural, as far as we could see it, world of that day. This will happen, again, in verse 10, in the day when the root of Jesse, the Messiah of Israel, will stand up as a banner for the peoples. And all of these other nations are going to be there. Assyria, Lower Egypt, Upper Egypt, Cush, Elam, Babylonia, Hamath, the islands of the sea, the Philistines, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Egyptians, all here, all at the same time, while this wonderful event takes place. And there will be a highway as well. And I'd like to have a quick look at that in a few moments. But here's the hope. Well, let's go back. Chapter 35 says, strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear, your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with retribution. He will come and save you. This is the outcome of all of this turmoil in the Middle East. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and this miracle continues now through the kingdom of God on earth. The ears of the deaf unstopped, then the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb shout for joy. And the world had a sense of that when Jesus came the first time. But clearly, there's a finality about all of these prophecies. It's going to happen again when all of these things line up. See, he says, you will see a king reigning in righteousness and rulers ruling in justice. The Lord will be exalted, for he dwells on high. He will fill Zion with justice and righteousness. Again, all verses taken from chapter 11 to 35. For the fear of the Lord is the key to this treasure. We've looked at that already. But here's Isaiah chapter 34, verse 8. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, the day again here, spoken of, a year of retribution to uphold Zion's cause. We might say, well, what is all this about? Well, there it is right in that verse. The ancient issues that God has with his people have not been fully resolved. They're going to be resolved, friends, at a time when all of these nations are going to be there again. Israel's going to be in their land. And that is the time, the day of the Lord, when the nations are going to be judged for how they treated Israel. And Israel is going to be judged, will repent, will accept their Messiah. And remarkably, there's going to be a highway. Now, this word highway comes up three or four times in this section of Isaiah from 11 to 35. There's a highway that is going to exist between Egypt and Assyria. Now, there may be something very sort of metaphorical about this, but I'm not sure we shouldn't see it somewhat literally. At the time these words were penned, as I was outlining to you, there was conflict between Syria, Assyria, Israel, Judah, and to some extent, Egypt, but not so much, where Israel and Judah, that were part of the Israelitish nation, were at odds with one another, forming alliances, basically, to try and protect themselves. Israel was constantly forming alliances. Israel's capital was in Samaria, with Damascus and the Syrians. The people in Judah, and this is one of the issues that Isaiah was dealing with, in order to protect themselves from the alliances between Syria and Israel, they were making attempts to be in league with Assyria, that was farther to the north. So Isaiah said, well, that's a great idea, but the problem is that once you do that and you make a league with Syria, and these other two nations that stand between you and Assyria are gone, Syria is going to come right down and take you out, which is exactly what Syria did. Assyria came down, and happily for Israel, its army was destroyed. In the center sections of Isaiah and in Chronicles, that event is recorded. So they were saved from Assyria. And at that time, there was a king by the name of Hezekiah. And Hezekiah, out of this great apparent defeat of the Assyrian army, by Hezekiah, that's how the world saw it, had a visit from Babylon. The Babylonians were quite interested in Judah, I'm assuming. And then, another 75 or 80 years later, we have a good king named Josiah who decided to engage the king of Egypt in Megiddo. Now, the king of Egypt had gone up to fight with the Assyrians in Carchemish to try and block the advance of the Babylonian Empire. And Josiah was killed there. He was a good king, too, but he lost his life. And the Egyptians and the Assyrians overall lost the battle against the Babylonians. And finally, the Babylonians came down and took out the nation of Judah, as Isaiah had promised, had prophesied. But in any case, you can see this highway, this corridor from Egypt right up to Assyria that was there. This corridor, as far as Isaiah is concerned, is going to be a highway of holiness in the end, as God brings together the nations of the earth out of this terrible destruction and disaster that's going on in the land and brings them back in harmony. Your eyes, he says, will see the king in his beauty and view a land that stretches afar. And the ransomed of the Lord, we read this in chapter 35, will return, entering Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. And here really is the call to action by Isaiah. And these types of calls are embedded again in throughout the prophecy of Isaiah. O people of Zion who live in Jerusalem, you will weep no more. How gracious he will be when you cry for help. As soon as he hears, he will answer you. With your own eyes you will see him, whether you turn to the right or to the left. Your eyes will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. It was the Lord's way that was the way of redemption, not only to Israel, but to the whole earth. And that, friends, includes you and I, who sometimes see ourselves at a distance from Israel, but the hope is eternal. The hope is universal. Jesus, in speaking of the final time and day, says that you will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. This is how the branch, the Messiah of Israel, returns to the earth to set up his kingdom and bring peace. When all of these, as we might say today, ducks are lined up in terms of all the nations, existing original nations, Israel, and all of these situations, these things begin to take place. Stand up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. And that's how we as Christadelphians see the world today. And that's why we put out the same call to action that the prophets of old did. The voice that should be saying to us from behind, whether we turn to the left or to the right, this is the way, come and walk in it.
Thank you, Clyde. You, Clyde. You, Clyde. You, Clyde. You, Clyde. You, Clyde.